Today at Reader's Corner, Robert Putnam, author of Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The belief that prosperity and success are open to everyone is at the heart of our national identity. Yet according to today's guest, Robert Putnam, the gap between those who have the chance to forge a better future and those who are being left behind is getting wider. As a result, our kids, America's poorest among them, are experiencing a transformation of American society that comes at a cost to every one of us. Dr. Putnam is the author of Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. Through stories and statistics, Our Kids documents the divergent opportunities available to rich and poor children and how these disparities are reshaping our nation's culture and future. The book is now out in paperback. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Robert Putnam. He is the Malkin Professor of Public Policy at Harvard University and the author of more than a dozen books, including the bestseller, Bowling Alone. Dr. Putnam's influential books and research have garnered national and international recognition. He has consulted with Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama, as well as with national leaders from countries around the world. In 2012, he received the National Humanities Medal, the nation's highest honor for contributions to the humanities. Dr. Putnam joins us from the studios at Harvard University. Robert Putnam, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks very much, Bob. I'm looking forward to being with you. We can both call each other Bob because we share that name.
Exactly, exactly. Well, let's start with this idea of what you call equality of opportunity and social mobility. Help us understand that.
Well, it's true that, as probably everybody in the country knows now, there's been a growing inequality in the distribution of income among adult Americans or among American families over the last 30 or 40 years. Folks who are relatively affluent and well-educated have gotten much more affluent over these last 20 or 30 years, and people sort of average or below average income and education have done a lot less well. So there's a big gap. But historically, Americans have not been so concerned about the distribution of where you end up in the sense that we basically assume that everybody gets on the ladder at the same point, and if some people climb higher, Bill Gates or Warren Buffett or whatever climb higher, well, that's because they're better climbers or they work harder at it, on the assumption that everybody's getting on the ladder at the same point. But about that is, do all kids get a fair and equal start in life? Do their chances depend upon what they do or don't do, what talents and energies and so on they have, and not upon what their parents did or didn't do? That assumption, equality of opportunity, is at the very core of the American project. The very first thing we said when we became a country to the rest of the world was, the very first sentence was, we believe that all men are created equal. Now, of course, at that point, this is the 17th century, or 18th century, we meant all white men, and we certainly meant men. We didn't mean women. But over time, that fundamental national commitment to the idea that every kid in America ought to have a fair chance at doing well in life, and whatever you achieve shouldn't depend upon what your parents did or didn't do, that's core to our national identity. It's what referred to by the American dream. And if my evidence in this book is right, and I think it is, that fundamental tenet that everybody should have a fair start in life is increasingly out of reach for many Americans.
And the way you measure the difference between and among classes is a little different in the sense that it's not all about wealth or income. You use education. Explain how you have ranked or how you have separated out the classes as far as education is concerned.
Well, the reason I do that, I do it for two reasons. One is we have much better data on people's education, and especially when you're talking to kids, they're more likely to know what their parents' education level is than they are to know what their parents' income is. So that's just a technical reason why we tend not to use income. But the other is that increasingly in America, how much money people make depends upon their level of education. I'm going to speak loosely probably here on this in our discussion about rich kids and poor kids. But when I say rich kids, I do not mean Bill Gates' kids. I'm talking about kids coming from the upper third of American society, which is, roughly speaking, college-educated parents. Roughly, if you have a college degree, that means automatically you're kind of in the upper third of American society. And I'm comparing kids from that kind of background to kids whose parents didn't get past high school. They may have gotten a high school degree or maybe not, but they didn't get past high school. That, in rough numbers, is the lower third of American families or American adults. And in other words, when I talk about rich kids and poor kids, I'm not comparing Bill Gates' kids to some homeless kids. I'm talking about basically, you know, my grandchildren. I'm not wealthy, but I'm in the upper third because I've got a college degree. And I'm comparing them to other people just like them, whose parents, however, did not get beyond high school.
And I must say, I hope everybody gets a chance to read this book, but the very many contrasts you draw between the upper third and the lower third are just incredible. And I thought I understood that, but I didn't until I read your book. So the research for your book and its findings is based on an extensive set of interviews of families about their lives and circumstances in various places, two neighborhoods in Atlanta, Philadelphia, and a suburb, Bend, Oregon, Orange right. County, California, and the most important one, since it's taking you home, Port Clinton, Ohio, where Bob Putnam was born and raised. Was Thomas Wolfe right? You can't go home again?
Well, it was a lot of fun going home again, I have to say. Port Clinton is a little town on Lake Erie. I grew up there in the 1950s. I graduated from Port Clinton High School in 1959, and it was about 5,000 people then, mostly white folks, but there were some non-whites in the town, and it's about 5,000 people now. And I had remembered the town as being a nice place to grow up. There was nobody very rich, nobody very poor in town. And now, 50 or 60 years later, we can go back and talk to my classmates, those of them who are still alive. And what we discovered was my class, we had enormously good fortune in life. 80% of us did better than our parents in terms of education and income. And even more striking, the kids from the so-called wrong side of the tracks have done just about as well as the kids from the right side of the tracks. So it was not because we were particularly bright. We weren't. We didn't come from very affluent backgrounds at all. 40% of us were the first in our family to graduate from high school. But of the kids who were the first in their family to graduate from high school, they were coming from pretty modest backgrounds. Half of them graduated from college. So lots of opportunity for upward mobility in that town. But when you fast forward in Port Clinton and you come up to the present time, what you discover is, first of all, that Port Clinton has become a kind of a typical Rust Belt decaying town. The downtown now, you know, which I remember very vividly, the place where I would go for sodas after school or the local Five and Dime or whatever, those shops are all boarded up, and because all the local factories that were the employers of my classmates' dads, they're all closed. The fishing industry is gone because the pollution of Lake Erie. And now there's a lot of really poor kids in Port Clinton. And when we talk to those poor kids in Port Clinton, they are living an unbelievably awful life. I think that's the only way to put it. They have no prospects of going to college. Many of them have no prospects of ever getting a job. They are living lives of desperation. Their families are fractured. They mostly are coming from broken families. They don't have any support from local organizations or the schools or whatever. And in the opening chapter of the book, I describe a couple of these kids and compare them to my own grandchildren. These kids and my own grandchildren are both grandchildren from Port Clinton of the 1950s. And I'm proud of my grandchildren. They're all either now in or on their way to America's best universities. But my grandchildren did one smart thing. They chose college-educated parents in a period when college-educated Americans were going to do well economically. And Mary Sue, one of these kids in Port Clinton that we talked to, Mary Sue made only one bad decision, really, herself. She chose high school-educated parents in a time in which the economy was so bad for high school-educated parents that her parents basically never held a steady job. And if I can go just a little bit more about the story of Port Clinton, because it's actually typical of America. As I say, most of Port Clinton is kind of a basket case economically, but Port Clinton has an advantage that it's on Lake Erie, a beautiful site. When I was growing up, it was mostly fruit orchards and fishing camps along there. But it's now one long gated community, about 20 miles long and about 150 yards deep, right on the shore of million-dollar mansions. And the kids who are growing up in that stretch of town are living in a completely different world from the kids just on the other side of the road who are living in poverty. I mean, there's a road you can go down in Port Clinton. I could take you down it. And if you look to the left toward the lake, that census tract has zero poor kids. Not surprisingly, they're all million-dollar mansions. But if you look just to the other side of the road at the, you know, the dilapidated double wides and the shacks and so on, the child poverty rate there is 50%. And those kids are not living in the same universe as the kids just on the other side of the road. That's new. And I wouldn't be telling the story about Port Clinton if it were peculiar to this little town in the Midwest. But as you say, we've done similar kinds of research in Orange County and Bend, Oregon and Philadelphia and the Boston suburbs. And that contrast is true everywhere in America.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Robert Putnam, author of Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. Dr. Putnam is a professor at Harvard University. His previous books include the bestseller Bowling Alone. Let's talk a little bit about what you find behind the doors of those homes in Port Clinton or some of the other communities you've studied, like Bend. You refer to the college-educated, neo-traditional marriage pattern and then the high school-educated pattern. Explain what you're getting at there and how different the changing family structure is.
Well, there's been a huge change in the family structure. The vast majority of kids who are growing up in college-educated homes, that is where their parents have a college degree, are living in two-parent families. And the divorce rate among college-educated Americans has been declining for 20 or 30 years. So something like 95 or 93% of kids in America growing up in upper third homes, that is in college-educated homes, are living with their two parents. No, it looks almost like Ozzie and Harriet, except that now Harriet has a job and Ozzie's helping out a little bit more around the house. But it's basically a neo-traditional family. On the other hand, over this last 30 years, the families of kids growing up in the working class have dramatically changed. And the rate of single-parentness among those kids has grown. Used to be in the 50s, it was something like 15%, and it's now something like 70%. More than two-thirds of all kids in America who are growing up in high school-educated homes have only a single parent, usually a single mom. And I want to be careful here because I'm not trying to blame that mom. If anybody was going to blame, it would be the absent dad. But these are kids growing up in what are called fragile families. There's a classic case of that in the story we tell about a young woman growing up in poverty in Bend, Oregon. Her family is really a basket case, frankly. And I'm not trying to make a moral judgment about people who have kids and they're not and without being married. That's not my point. The evidence, the scientific evidence, now clearly shows, and I'm on the left of the spectrum politically, so I'm not making a moral point here. It just is easier to raise kids if you've got two parents in the home. And so a lot of the problems, by no means all, but a lot of the problems that face kids coming from the lower half of the economic spectrum now are they begin with family disarray. And that is true across races. Once upon a time, people thought this was, I don't know, something about black families, that they were in disarray. But it turns out it wasn't about the race. It was about living in extreme poverty, which is what is true for many of these people in that part of the economic hierarchy. Mm-hmm.
Well, whether you're Harriet, who's off to work, or whether you're the single mom, daycare is absolutely required. And you address the fact that the quality of daycare differs significantly between that upper third and the lower third. Help us understand that.
Well, it's absolutely true. If I were the czar, I'd try to make sure that every mom had substantial maternity leave really for the first year. What the evidence says is the best kind of childcare, at least for the first year, is provided by the mom if the mom can stay home. Now, of course, many of these moms, and especially the moms who are living in poverty, they can't possibly do that, and their employers don't provide that. And I'm not trying to lay a guilt trip on moms who work outside the home. Indeed, both my daughter and my daughter-in-law work outside the home. So I understand the realities. But there are different levels of quality of child care that are available to parents. And the gaps, these gaps that I'm talking about, the opportunity gap, begins opening up very early. And it opens up partly because of real differences in how much time during the day well-off parents can spend with their children, and comparing that to kids, similar kids, but coming from less well-off homes, we have in the book a measure of what we call good night moon time, how much time parents spend reading to their kids or playing pat a cake with them or whatever. And it didn't used to be there was any class difference in good night moon time. Working class parents and middle class parents spent the same amount of time reading and playing with their kids. But now, over the last 20 or 30 years, a big gap has opened up so that now kids coming from well-off homes get, on average, 45 minutes a day more time with mom or dad reading to them or playing with them or whatever than similarly placed kids in poor homes. And if you think that 45 minutes a day more of goodnight moon time is trivial, that must be because you don't know the most recent brain science. In the last 10 years, we have learned a lot about how the child's brain develops. And the interaction between an adult or a parent and an infant, even really young, you know, birth to three, is crucially important for the physical development of the brain. And therefore, that 45 minutes a day gap in goodnight moon time has long-run consequences. And then, of course, the story continues. I mean, as you move forward, you think about early childhood education, and most countries in the world now are providing substantial early childhood education to kids, you know, like Head Start, but other forms of early childhood education. And we know, the evidence shows, that does make a difference. But unless you're lucky enough to live in a state where there's a lot of early childhood education provided, that is another way in which the gap opens up between the families that can afford to do that on their own and the families that can't.
Well, unfortunately, Bob, I'm not living in a state that's fortunate enough to have early childhood education high on its priority list, and we're working on that. But I understand that you just visited Oklahoma, which is a state not too dissimilar from Idaho, and apparently they have it very high on their list.
Yeah. You know, it's really interesting. I spent a couple of days in Oklahoma City and in Tulsa, and Oklahoma, you know, is maybe the reddest state in America. I mean, it's a very conservative state and not a state you would think that would be one of the, in the vanguard of providing social help like this. But in fact, Oklahoma is probably the national leader in providing early childhood education to all of their kids. First of all, there is a statewide, high-quality pre-K program available to all Oklahoma kids in the year before kindergarten. So 4 years old, basically. The state pays for every kid, rich or poor, in Oklahoma to have a high-quality pre-K year. And then, overlaid on that, or underlaid on that, the foundation of that is that lots of private philanthropists, especially some philanthropists in Tulsa, have provided for birth to three parenting and parenting support and sort of child care plus, I would say. It's not just babysitting. It's not at all just babysitting. They have trained professional child care providers. And the data show it makes a difference. The opportunity gap in Oklahoma is being narrowed by that investment. Now, of course, it's costly. But, you know, providing a high school education is costly. Providing any kind of education for our kids is costly. But it's a darn good investment. And that's what the people in Oklahoma have decided.
One of the pieces of evidence that is perhaps strongest to show what happens to these kids by the time they get into school, whether it's elementary or high school, is what you refer to as the achievement gap. And I believe you're using the metric of math and reading scores at some fairly young ages. But there seem to be some significant differences between high and low income families in that regard.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and not only are there big differences in test scores, but those differences have been growing rapidly over the last 30 years. I mean, that's one of the examples that the evidence is quite clear. We are, you know, you might ask the question, well, how are American kids doing on these standard measures of cognitive skills, reading and math and so on? And the answer depends entirely on, you know, how well they're off their parents are. If kids coming from affluent homes, my grandchildren and people like them, are doing better than ever. Their test scores would place us in the top ranks in the world. But at the same time, we've been increasingly failing the kids coming from the lower third of the hierarchy. And one of the consequences of that, this is just so tragic, is we are wasting a ton of talent, of kids who could really make major contributions to our economy, but because we're not providing them with the skills, both the hard skills and also the soft skills, that are necessary so that they can contribute to the modern economy, all of the rest of us will be paying a price for that fact. The best econometric estimate of the cost for not investing in poor kids in America over their lifetime is something like $5 trillion, a huge amount of opportunity that we're not, as a country, being able to exploit, and talent we're not being able to draw on because of this class gap.
I'm Bob Custer, a host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Robert Putnam about his book, Our Kids. The book is about how rich and poor Americans are living, learning, and raising children in increasingly separate and unequal worlds, and the consequences for society as we know it. You know, you comment in your book on the role that extracurricular activities play in the life of a high school student, for example, and that varies too in higher income areas or higher class areas as opposed to the lower third. And you hit on one thing in particular that I thought was really interesting, and I have some experience with this because I've seen the cost of my grandchildren participating in basketball, for example, and baseball. And it's pay to play in high school. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, as you do this work, I learned a lot of things that I didn't know before we began this project. And some of it makes me just really angry, honestly. extracurricular activities, you know, band or chorus or football or French club or basketball or whatever, they were invented all across America around 1910, 1920, that kind of period. God did not invent high school football, but it was invented by ordinary Americans in towns and cities all across America, and for the purpose of inculcating soft skills. They didn't have that word yet, but they meant grit and determination and what my mom called stick-to-itiveness and teamwork. And the evidence shows it actually works. It turns out that if you take part in high school sports or high school extracurricular activities, you will, in fact, earn a higher lifetime income than you would if the same you didn't have that, because, on average, kids who take part in extracurricular activities do learn the soft skills, the, as I say, grit and teamwork and so on, that employers will pay for. And so there is a real insight that our ancestors 100 years ago, they saw that. And so when I was growing up in Port Clinton in the 1950s, the good taxpayers of Port Clinton paid for my trombone, and they paid for 4 years of trombone lessons, and they paid for the conductor and the music and the auditorium, and I played football, so they paid for my spikes and my pads and my helmet and the Friday night lights and the coaches. And they were doing that not because I was special, just because they did that for everybody in town. And I learned a lot from those experiences. But nationwide, in the last 10, 15 years, we've had this insidious practice spreading of what's called pay to play. So now in Port Clinton, if you want to play football or you want to, you know, play in the band or whatever, your parents have got to ante up, you know, maybe $1,600 a year so you can play football or play trombone. And, you know, if your annual income is $200,000, well, $1,600 is trivial. But if your annual income is $16,000, well, who in their right mind is going to spend a 10% of their total annual family income on your kid playing football? And the answer is fewer and fewer people. And therefore, the charts and graphs in the book show unequivocally this collapse in extracurricular activities among working class kids. I think that's evil. I mean, that's just wrong. And I'm proud to say that in my home state of Ohio, I get on my soapbox there as elsewhere around the country, and the Republican Secretary of State in Ohio has made it his job now to try to reverse pay-to-play across Ohio, to try to convince all local school districts that they've got to find other ways to cover their financial shortfalls, because it's just not fair to exclude kids from that kind of educational experience just because their parents can't afford it.
I have a little example. For your second edition, some of these high school coaches will then take certain kinds of skills and competencies in a sport and offer them as a clinic outside of the high school, charging the parent for it and basically guaranteeing that if you sign up for this and pay for it, then you can make the team. If you don't, you may not make the team.
And holy cow. That makes me even angrier.
Yeah, that's going on in some suburbs I'm aware of, and I don't mean in Idaho, but having grandchildren in other places gives me a little perspective. Let's talk a little bit about a quote that I was very impressed with, because back when I did live in Chicago, I worked with members of the religious community in the inner city and saw how effective they were. But your quote says, regarding the role of the religious community in lifting up kids who are less fortunate than others, if you listen carefully, hymns in American houses of worship are increasingly sung in upper-class accents. Explain.
Yeah, well, what we've seen in the data, and there's lots of evidence here that's in the book, is that over the last 20 or 30 years, working-class kids and often working-class families have pulled out of the social infrastructure, so to speak, of our towns and communities. They're no longer so active in local organizations, and they're less involved in churches. And historically, churches were one of the main sources of social support for kids, especially for working-class kids. To put that a different way, one of the few places historically that working-class kids could be sure that someone, an adult, outside their own family, was paying attention to them. You know, either a Sunday school teacher or a youth pastor or just some member of the congregation. But as the church attendance of working-class kids has plummeted, and it has plummeted over the last 30 years, fewer and fewer working-class kids have access to that informal network of mentors and social support and so on. Back in the day, and when I'm talking about Port Clinton, many of the working-class kids in Port Clinton were able to go to college because the pastor sort of spotted them and said, let me help you figure out how we're going to get you to college. And that can't happen if the working-class kids are no longer in church. So my previous book was a book called American Grace, and it was a detailed examination of America's religious communities, and I have enormous regard for the ability, capacity of America's religious communities of all denominations to provide financial and social support for needy kids and needy people. So I think we need an even deeper involvement of religious communities in trying to narrow this opportunity gap. And frankly, we also need to have the voices of the America's religious communities in the public arena talking about the fact that these are all our kids. It's not like, you know, in Port Clinton, if you talk to people now about poor kids, they say, well, they're not my kids. They're somebody else's kids. Let them worry about them. And that, if I can say it this way, is that's deeply unchristian to say, oh, these other kids are not my kids, so I'm not going to worry about them. They're all our children. That's why the book has a title, Our Kids.
I have time for one more question, and the last chapter is entitled What is to be Done? And it's a great list of proposals, public policy issues that we could address here if we only had the time. Let's just take one of those, especially since President Obama has indicated a strong interest in prison reform. One of yours was reducing incarceration. Help us understand how that fits into your argument here.
Well, this is now, I think, has become no longer a partisan issue. I think I've talked to politicians from both parties in Washington and around the country, and it's clear that we went overboard in the war on drugs and sent a lot of people off to prison, young men off to prison for nonviolent crimes who shouldn't be there. And their absence, the absence of those, you know, young men and dads from communities of all races, but especially of among minorities, is a serious problem for the kids, for their kids. A startlingly high proportion of all the poor kids that we interviewed for this book, of all races, had a parent in prison, mostly the dad. And the absence of that parent is a big part of the story here. I'm not talking about – and there's now a nationwide bipartisan effort. I think probably there's going to be major progress made on this over the next couple of years around the country. I don't know the politics of this in Iowa and in Idaho, but many places around the country are now talking about prison reform that would lower the rate of incarceration.
Robert Putnam, we've run out of time, and I'm so sorry. Bob, I want to thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Again, the name of the book is Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis by Robert Putnam, soon to be out in paperback. Thanks for being with us, Bob.
Thanks very much, Bob.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Robert Putnam. Next week, Matthew Palmer, a 25-year veteran of the U.S. Foreign Service and the author of a new political thriller, The Wolf of Sarajevo. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Deborah Palmer. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. To listen to previous interviews anytime, download our free app from the iTunes App Store or Google Play. You'll also find links to previous shows on our website, That's BoiseStatePublicRadio.org.